You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
I'm very pleased to be joined by three wonderful panellists today who are going to talk about their experience around campaigning for better walking and cycling infrastructure. Before I introduce them, I just wanted to warm everyone up with a few questions. So we're going to have some hand raising in a moment now, just to get a feel for where everyone's at with this. So firstly, who here has ever been involved in some sort of campaign for better transport infrastructure? Okay, that's not bad. That's a good 10 to 20 people. Thank you. Who here has ever responded to a public consultation with their local authority? That's very impressive and definitely a higher proportion than the general public. Okay, maybe who has ever ridden a bike or walked to school or work ever? Nice. Who has ever ridden a bike or walked to school or work and then told someone about what a nice journey they'd had? Excellent. So you're all in the right place, I can tell you, for the conversation that's going to continue over the next hour. First of all, I would like to introduce Dave. Dave Walker. So I'll introduce Dave, who's going to give us a little introduction of himself first. Dave is probably the world's most famous cartoonist operating at the intersection between the idiosyncrasies of church-going British life and cycling. And he'll be able to tell you a bit more about that right now. So, Dave, over to you.
Thank you very much. So I want to talk a bit about my cartoons and campaigning, how I came to do it, my motivation, and whether it works. I'll be talking about cycling campaigning, as that's what I know about, but I suspect some of the principles might apply more widely. So, how and why does a church newspaper cartoonist end up drawing cycling cartoons? Well, cartooning was never part of the plan. However, I left school with a D in A-level art, so the world was my oyster. And I started out drawing cartoons in college, addressing thorny issues such as the storage of the communal milk. Without a huge amount of artistic competence, it must be said. Now, the details of how things progressed are beyond the scope of this session, but I kept on drawing and eventually had the good fortune to be able to draw cartoons for the Church Times. Fast forward to 2012, when, if you remember, we all went slightly cycling mad. We had the Olympics, Bradley Wiggins, etc. And so diversifying my subject matter seemed like a good idea. And cycling seemed like a sensible choice, as it's something I've enjoyed and always enjoyed, and something that I know about. So at the time, I was riding a road bike quite a lot. So Lycra, the full works. And almost every time I went out, I would experience what I would call a close pass, i.e. a car coming too close to me. And so on almost every ride, I would just come back really, you know, why am I, as a person on a bike, not able to feel safe? And I think maybe that is part of the motivation behind what I do, a frustration with the way things are. Why should people be put in danger because of traffic just because they ride a bike? Why aren't there safe routes for people on bikes so they don't have to mingle with cars? And that's me speaking as an adult who's quite experienced as a cyclist. So how much more for a child or somebody who's new to cycling? And I'm speaking as a man, so how do women feel on routes that are isolated and badly lit? Why don't we have a choice in how we get from A to B, particularly for short journeys? There are also social justice aspects. Why should you be able to need to afford a car to get from A to B within a town? So yes, frustration is a significant part of my motivation. So I wanted to say a little bit about how I try to draw cartoons about cycling and campaigning cartoons. My aim is to focus on the positives of cycling if I can. The benefits, health, environment, ability to stop and say hello, and the fact it's just a good, it's fun, it's a good way to get around. But one of the dangers is that you can quite easily get drawn into culture wars of people who want to pit drivers against cyclists. And I think this is a really unhelpful polarization. And so it's something I do try to avoid. But yes, sometimes it just becomes necessary to answer some of the points that people are making about people who ride bikes. I also try to put my campaigning into practice locally, wherever I can. And I'm really fortunate that having had years and years of being a bit of an oddity where I live, the only person riding a bike, sort of people look at you and think, what is that thing? What's going on? I've found a little team of people, the Billericay Cycling Campaign, who live in a town near me. And I've been able to work with them and also work with our local cycling officer in the local council. So, excuse my shuffling my notes, but actually campaign for me is largely starts with the tiny things. It's about how you interact with, so every day I ride my bike just about, and I ride on shared paths. And for me, campaigning is about how I interact with the people I meet. So dog walkers, just people walking along the paths. And I always hope that they will think, oh, that he said hello, he was polite, he didn't zoom past. And so maybe in some small way that changes a preconception. My question, I suppose, is does drawing pictures work as a method of campaigning? I'd be hard-pressed to point to a single metre of segregated cycleway that has come about as part of a cartoon. And if you know of one, I'd love to hear of it. Ultimately, when you put work out there, you lose control of it, which is a good and bad thing. And who knows who will see it and what effect it might have. I've been very fortunate to be able to draw cartoons for the national cycling charity Cycling UK, helping them communicate their messages, whether it's about potholes, ways to save fuel, or encouraging people to contact their MP about cycling. And I hope that my work might make a difference in several ways. So giving local campaigners resources to help them get their point across, both to decision makers and local people. And then allowing people online to express something that perhaps they feel, but they want more than just typed words to put across. And hopefully a picture might allow them to articulate that. And also silly pictures might help to boost morale slightly. Anyway, so whether it actually changes minds, I ask this question a lot, particularly when I'm on a late night deadline and I think, you know, what is this really achieving? So anyway, I'm not attempting to suggest that everyone else should do what I do, not least because having a peloton of cycling cartoonists wouldn't be great for business. Not least because some of you could probably draw better than I can. But actually, creativity in whatever form is a really desirable attribute for those campaigning for more sustainable transport. Thinking about how to get your message across, how you communicate, creating a presence online at events, getting people on your side is all really important. This is a time of change with a new government, and who knows, with creativity, let's be hopeful about how we might be able to influence things. So I hope the little comic that you see in front of you provides some inspiration And perhaps helps you realise that perhaps by just riding a bike and using walking, cycling, that perhaps you are already on the route to becoming a cycling campaigner. And hopefully this might help you in some small way to take things to the next step. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dave. I'm going to come to... Before I ask Sarah to speak, I just think one of the things I find really interesting and inspiring about Dave's work and the use of art and creativity in this sort of way is, as Dave mentioned, that the topic around cycling, active travel, over the last couple of years has become quite a divisive topic. The way it's portrayed in the media is all about pitting one group of people, one class of people against another group of people, the motorists versus the cyclists. And it's got quite nasty at times, in the public discourse. And I think the use of art and comic art in particular is quite clever because it sits above that mess and actually gives people a way into the conversation that feels maybe a bit, it's a different way in, and it feels like you're not then maybe part of the mudslinging in the same way, which I think is really wonderful. So thank you very much, Dave, and thank you for producing this piece of art that everyone has in their pockets that will no doubt be seeing pop up on eBay over the course of the next week. Limited edition artwork, people, in your pockets. Next, I'd like to introduce Sarah Robery next to me. Sarah works for the Clean Cities campaign in Manchester and is going to talk a little bit about more of the kind of the wider mechanisms of how campaigning at a kind of a broader level can work.
Brill, thanks, Wes. Hi, everyone. I'm Sarah. I'm the Greater Manchester campaigner for the Clean Cities campaign. We work ultimately on the vision of getting polluting vehicles out of cities across Europe. One of the things we campaign for is for more people to have easy access to walking, wheeling, cycling, so better and more accessible active travel. Not everybody put their hand up at the start when Wes asked whether or not you consider yourselves, if you've been a travel campaigner. And I guess the first thing I want to emphasise is that if you care about climate change, if you care about air pollution, if you care about health inequality, if you care about people's access to education or work opportunities, if you care about kids being able to travel safely and independently to school, then all of those things, like a very local and practical example of making those things better, is the way that we get around in our towns and communities. So maybe by the end, we'll persuade you that you can be and would love to be a transport campaigner, even though transport in and of itself maybe doesn't sound the most exciting. I was just going to touch upon a few different sort of campaigning tools, I guess, to help you if you are getting involved or thinking about starting something locally, a couple of tools that you could think about in your own campaigning. And then Josh, I think, is going to talk a bit more specifically about examples from Cambridge, and then we'll get into questions. So just things to help you think about how to go about if you see something that you want to change or what to do about that. So the first thing I was just going to talk about is having a theory of change, which sort of is a necessarily technical name, I guess, for just thinking through what you want to do. So just to like try and be as specific as possible about what it is you want to change and how you're going to go about doing that. And a really quick and simple way of thinking about that is just thinking through like who it is that you want to take an action if you don't have the power yourself to change something, why they should care about it, what you want them to do about it, and how you're going to do that, basically. So a very simple one is to think, like, to fill out these sentences. I want to get my local councillors, for example, who care about children's health, maybe transport might not be your way in, to support local school streets might be one example, and by demonstrating, it might be you could get some head teachers on board, for example, if you already work in education. So like get somebody who already cares about this to do something by, and then that last bit is really key, like what is it you're going to do. Another thing to think about if you're sort of setting out thinking about campaigning is to do a little bit of power mapping, which is basically just to think about who has the power in a situation and what power you have and who you can influence that might have some influence on them. So basically just to make sure you are influencing the right people. So some local authority, transport, setups seem initially quite complicated, but like, who is it that you have the power to influence, and how can you use them to influence the people that have the power to make the change? So thinking about people that you can get on side, and it's worth thinking about who may already be on side versus how powerful they are, for example, and just like doing a bit of thinking through how you can influence the right people, just to make sure you don't spend lots of time trying to influence somebody that actually doesn't have the power to make the change that you need to see.
Sorry, Sarah, on that, can you give a couple of examples of who those people might be in Manchester, for example? Who would those people be?
Yeah, so it will look like, possibly look slightly different in every situation. The Greater Manchester scenario is slightly complicated by the fact that we're a combined authority. So Greater Manchester, our transport authority is transport for Greater Manchester. So some things are decided at a Greater Manchester level, but the highways authority is usually your local authority, so your local council. And there will be a cabinet member who is responsible for transport normally, and you will obviously have your own ward councillors who will have some powers on your behalf to engage with your local councillors. So even the power mapping in itself needs to sort of take a little bit of time. And finally, I just really want to emphasize, Dave's already talked about it brilliantly, but like the power of telling your own story and ways that you can do that. There's a community organizing technique about telling your story called the story of self, the story of us, and the story of now. And it's just a really powerful way of thinking through making connections with people by telling your story in a way that gets them on board in order to influence the moment that we have now. Famously, Barack Obama is probably the best person in the whole world at using this technique. But you don't have to be Barack Obama to use your story to get other people on board. So just thinking about, the people that you can influence in your own communities and how you can talk to them in a way that might also get them interested in the thing that you are interested in and why this moment is important. We'll stop there.
Thank you very much. We'll move on to Josh now, and then we'll bring it to the floor for questions. So Josh over here, for anyone who hasn't had the pleasure of meeting him so far, is infrastructure campaigner for the Cambridge Cycle Campaign, and we'll talk a bit more specifically about what the nuts and bolts of a real life, very effective campaign organisation looks like.
Thanks, Wes. Hi, everybody. For CamCycle, I'm the infrastructure campaigner. I have a background as a civil engineer and kind of worked in street design for a long time. So that's kind of my role, but today I get to ride on the coattails of all of the people involved at CamCycle, as Wes said, which is the Cambridge Cycling Campaign. We've been around for 29 years, and for those who don't know, Cambridge is the cycling capital of the UK. We've got twice the rate of cycling as Oxford, which has twice the rate of cycling as anywhere else. So just to kind of give you a scale of like where we're at and the journey we've gone on. And without giving CamCycle all of the credit, much of the infrastructure and in Cambridge has been influenced by the campaign and through effective campaigning. So I'm just going to, instead of use notes, just go through this handy tool and talk through some of the things that CamCycle has done really effectively. So one of the first things that we do is we share that joy of cycling. We reach out to our members. We've got 1,700 members and obviously a much wider social media presence than that. And we share positive messages about, why people cycle, the joys of it and the what's possible by kind of making this infrastructure. So our magazines are all available online. I would really recommend anybody just having a look at them sometime. Lots to be learned from in there. We also have, as I said, 1,700 members with a hugely diverse skill set. So I'm able to bring in kind of an engineering background, and I talk very specifically about infrastructure a lot of the time, like what are the changes that we need to make on the ground, working with effectively the highway authorities and planning authorities and developers to physically change stuff. But there's so much more that goes into CamCycle, from people who enable kind of the systems that we operate in. We're able to look very professional well, we are very professional, I suppose. through things like our copy editing software and our messaging, which our brilliant volunteers all contribute towards. So there's this huge diverse skill set that we're able to leverage across our members by kind of connecting them up and engaging, which is great. There you go. I do a lot of this, praising good and bad infrastructure. So really kind of getting into the details of what's being proposed. And we've had a lot of success as a campaign in making small changes, you know, little things like curbs and positioning, and just to ease the experience for people to cycle. Because now Cambridge is in a relatively good position financially in terms of how cycle infrastructure is looked at, and people will kind of say, oh, we can't do what Cambridge does, we're not in that position. But flashback to where the campaign started and its roots in cycling actually being banned in the city centre, it was a very different landscape, and the little things that the campaign did over a prolonged period of time with low cost intervention really helped to create a network that, whilst far from perfect, gave people that transport opportunity. And I'd just go on to one of the key things that we focus on is consultations and messaging. It was great to see earlier how many of you put your hand up to say that you responded to consultations. I spend a lot of time looking at consultations, and they're pretty bad most of the time. So fair play for sticking at it. And one of the things we try to do as a campaign is to make those consultations more accessible. So we do things like consultation responses for our members. You know, how can I take my engineering skills, but ensure that we're communicating them in a way that people understand how this infrastructure is going to look on their street? You know, what do these drawings mean? What does this technical 200-page document actually going to influence on your street? So we do a lot of work on that, using kind of our expertise to allow people to respond to those consultations easier and really get that messaging across. So yeah, I will leave it there on just some of the stuff that CamCycle has done, but I'm sure we'll have plenty of opportunity to get into more of it. So thanks.
Thank you very much, Josh, Sarah, and Dave. So it's kind of over to you now. You know, what we're hoping through the course of the next half an hour is that we can generate some good questions, hopefully some quite specific questions about people's interests in being involved in campaigning around infrastructure, whether that's walking, cycling, public transport. Maybe we'll try and limit it not to being long accounts of personal stories of past failures and successes. But that's great. So thank you for having those past failures and successes on behalf of the question that you now won't ask. And yeah, so I think what we're going to do, people come to the front to ask into the mic. Is that...
If you're close to the front, if I can ask you to come forwards to the mic, and short, concise questions, not comments, is, I think, what we were looking for. And then if you're further to the pack, we're going to do a mixture because I can never hear stuff. So shout as loud as you can. I'll repeat it into the mic. And then if you would like to, am I right in thinking they can ask one of you directly a question, or they can ask an open question to any of you? Okay. Did anyone have a question? Well, that makes life easy.
Hi. One of the things that really winds me up, it's possibly too niche, is the amount of time it takes the pedestrian crossing and the cycle crossing to change when I press the button. Okay, so not too niche. And when we bring it up, we've got a campaigning group by Worcester. When we bring it up with the council, we've got two councils, the city and county, they say, oh, well, if we change the timings, then the traffic backs up and the pollution gets worse. So any thoughts? And is that true? Is that technically true? Because it drives us all nuts.
So just to bring it back to Cambridge, one of the things that we've been able to do with the Highway Authority is have a 7 second call to get that pedestrian or cycle button to come to you. Now it's kind of different on dependent on how the junction's set up, and obviously if you, in the most fundamental sense, yes, you are taking some capacity out, the theoretical capacity out of the network if you do that, but obviously one of the key things about improving walking, cycling in infrastructure is directness, convenience, you know. So leaning into those key policies, national policies that set up why that's the right thing to ease journeys, you have to get that message across, and then showing that other places do this and it has a big impact. So definitely possible. Keep going for that one.
And just to say, there is some evidence, I think it's from Finland, that shorter pedestrian crossing times is one of the things that has increased public transport ridership, because if it almost every journey that involves public transport starts with somebody walking, and if you make walking journeys easier, it makes people more likely to walk and public transport rather than use the car. So there's probably evidence out there that could help you make your case.
First of all, nice shirts. It is. So historic planning. Historic planning has focused on car-centric kind of planning rules. How do we overcome this and shift existing and future infrastructure to change typical public opinion away from car-centric use and towards like bikes and walking?
I'll do this one again because I spend a lot of time thinking about planning. One of the things that we do is we... And we've done it for a long, long time, is we take a real keen interest in planning applications. And we're doing that from an interrogation point. We're not objecting for the principle of planning. CamCycle is neutral on planning. But we're just constantly pushing policy to influence development. And it's probably really where we've had one of the greatest successes, because... And I suppose two things here is... And anybody in a kind of young fledgling campaign or thinking about setting up a campaign, responding to planning applications consistently is one of the best things that you can do, because it raises awareness within that system effectively. And we always kind of say we're a critical friend and a kind of trusted resource. And that's really how we establish that. Now, planning is just process effectively. And what is actually embedded in nearly all local plans are things like policy 80, sustainable travel. It's there because it's kind of set up from coming dribbling through kind of government documents. And you have that to leverage into. That will almost certainly exist. But what happens when nobody is leveraging it and being like, you said you were going to do this, by the way, then we just kind of get this kind of car-centric development. So really, if you can respond to planning applications and make sure that you're pulling them back on the policies and the commitments they've made. So we basically start by saying, we object to planning permission XYZ because it fails to align with policy 22, 24 and 80. And if you put a strong evidence base together for that, they're effectively kind of breaking the law if they're going against their own policies, and it can lead into that. That is how they assess it. So it can make a big impact that way.
I just wanted to provide a bit of a follow on from this. Because so in my other role, when I'm not chairing events at Greenbelt for the other 364 days a year, I'm also an engineer, and in a past life, myself and Josh have worked together. And just to give example of how effective campaign organizations such as CamCycle can be, one of the sites I've been working on for a long time is a 6,500 home new development on the edge of Cambridgeshire, and CamCycle are recognized as an influential voice in the area and are always writing those really annoying objections which we pay a lot of attention to. The result of that is that they then get a seat at the table. So we, as the engineers working for the private developers who are often thought as the bad guys, we on several occasions sat down with CamCycle and similar organisations to basically say, right, well, what are your ideas? How can we do this better? And there's a number of areas within this new town that's now happening. Small design elements, you know, the curb radii, where we've got raised tables, where we've got certain crossing types, that have been influenced by those conversations, which are essentially now more pedestrian and cycle friendly than they would have been without those conversations. So even though sometimes it can feel a bit futile and like these things are way too big, how can I ever influence them? You know, it can happen. And there's examples like that all over the place.
Hi, I can only speak for Wolverhampton, but years ago, when you were a child, you had to do your cycling proficiency. Everybody did it. And then for many years, it stopped and it wasn't done in schools. But now it's come back in. And I'm just wondering, how do you see that this is really beneficial in a way forward in really encouraging people to take up cycling as more of a way to travel rather than using other transport?
There's a recent academic study looking at what actually changes people's behaviour. And the answer is we do need those behaviour change type things, but they're only impactful if we also change the infrastructure. So to a certain extent, and I've heard people say this in Manchester, their kids are doing their bikeability training at school, but then there's nowhere safe for them to practice riding a bike. So they learn how to ride a bike and they don't ever really get a chance to do it because their parents won't let them ride on the road. So yeah, there's very strong evidence that that stuff is needed and is essential, but it only works for long-term change if it's also backed up by decent and safe infrastructure.
How much do you think that the ease of destination is important in getting people out there? I just thought, when people come by bike to church, where are you going to put your bike when you arrive? Because I don't know any churches in my town that's got anything you could fasten it to. And I know it'd wander off if you didn't. So there's a challenge for churches, I suppose. But how much is that important, the destination being usable for cyclists particularly? But yeah, that's just kind of it.
Yeah, I'm speaking as somebody who in my student days had a bike stolen whilst I was in a church service. And I was naive and thought, well, as long as it's locked to itself, it'll be fine. But of course it wasn't. And yeah, it's an important thing. And for churches, one thing is that there is funding quite often, not always, but depending, there's a bit of a geographical variance, I think is fair to say, but certainly in some places you can get funding for these things. But yeah, it's a really important thing.
And just to add, obviously we want to kind of retrofit those into churches, but back to the planning point, front and centre, we need to be thinking, you know, it's the first thing I look at. Where's the cycle parking? Is it near the front door? Is it visible? Because that all kind of contributes towards that. If cycle parking is front and centre, it's in people's minds, and it's campaigning without us doing anything, really. It's doing all the hard work for us.
And I think on that point, coming back to your point about power mapping, you know, in the church context, actually, we're then talking about different decision makers and different people of power. And probably people that are more accessible to you. If you're a regular churchgoer, the decision makers within the church are probably people you speak to on a regular basis. So actually, you know, have those conversations. And if there's enough people interested, in theory, it should be an easier thing to change.
Hi. So obviously, the planning stuff, amazing. And I'm part of a group in Birmingham called Better Streets of Birmingham. And Birmingham is such a car-centric city. I mean, it was planned that way. But yeah, so I get the planning thing and we're doing all of that. But how we have this big narrative of there's a war on drivers, and very much so the council have introduced a few low traffic neighbourhoods, like literally 50 metres. And it's very, very contentious. How can we change that narrative of actually it isn't a war on drivers? That's not actually true. I suppose it's like winning hearts and minds. Is it worth trying to do that, or do we just end up with, you know, fighting?
Dave, do you want to start on that one? Well,
yeah, I think it is worth doing it, is the short answer. It's hard work, I realise, but yes, I think it's worth doing it. Betsheets Firm, I think, are doing a great job, actually, because I see lots of their stuff. What I would say is that very vocal minority is often small, and it has power to shut up lots of people in the middle who probably agree with you but don't want to get into a fight. So I guess a place to start might be with talking to people who are not on the very against what you want to do, but probably for it, but just haven't thought about saying that out loud, and starting there. I think that stuff that trying to very briefly cover earlier about storytelling is really important. Like, what is at stake? And I think, yeah, those of us who care about all the things I mentioned earlier, climate, health, air pollution, we have to be better at making the case that this is important, and it's not a war on drivers. It's about making a place better for everybody. That includes people who drive cars, which probably includes us most, like, lots of the time. They're not like separate groups of people. I've slightly lost my train of thought. So, Dave.
Yeah, I suppose one other perspective might be that actually LTNs, low traffic neighbourhoods, have existed for decades. It's just that we haven't maybe called them that. But actually, when you look at how a town is laid out, often there are areas that where there isn't through traffic, and actually they've worked really well. But I suppose it's the creation of this, as I was saying before, the trying to pit people against each other and make it something more contentious than it needs to be.
I just think on that point, as some people may be aware, one of the reasons this became such a hot topic was basically during COVID, when loads of these things were rolled out really, really quickly without a huge amount of thought, of just being like, quickly, we need more space for people to walk, and therefore we have to take space away from cars. There was no consultation, no engagement with the public. It just happened, and people got really pissed off. And that kind of, ever since then, I think it's been difficult to pull the dialogue back in a more sensible direction. Hopefully, with the current government, the language around all of this will soften up, and will warm up, and people will start to feel that, oh, these aren't such scary things. After all, it's quite nice having pedestrianised areas.
Thank you. How do you encourage cyclists to behave well as part of using the improved infrastructure? I cycle in London. I see a lot of people jumping red lights and not behaving very well. Thank you.
We get a lot of emails about this as well, as you can imagine. People rather irate, like we are able to control behaviour. I would loosely say that really good infrastructure has really high levels of effectively expected, like people behave as expected. What you'll often find, I'm not endorsing jumping red lights, is that people are ultimately fundamentally annoyed at the system that they're having to operate in. They're operating in a car system, and they're constantly being classed as a second-rate citizen, and that kind of creates this annoyance. I think the best thing we can do is campaign for infrastructure that works for people, and talk about cycling culture. And what you see in the Netherlands is a much more homogenous kind of group. It's almost like a kind of flock, and it moves, and you get obedience in that way. So I think let's just work towards the system. Obedience will fall. Let's not get too caught up in it right now, would be my approach.
I was just quickly add, because I think there's a problem, particularly in Greater Manchester, I don't know about elsewhere, where people are particularly annoyed about the behaviour of delivery drivers on who ride bikes. And I would say it's also really important that we think about their working conditions, and the fact that they're not provided with decent equipment by their employer, and they're on 0 hours contracts, and they're probably not paid well enough. And that will be part of the reason that they are trying to deliver things as quickly as possible, and therefore not always waiting at a red light.
Person in the red. Shall I try and concise that into? You spoke about class, and rightly so, and I don't want to put too much emphasis on what may or may not be a class system for the whole of Cambridge. However, there was a few assumptions going on in there. But actually, in poorer areas, how do you help the campaign to be smoother, to help cyclists in those places where they don't have access to other transport areas. So it's a money saving thing as well.
Yeah, I got you. Yeah. So I'll talk Cambridge and then I'll just talk wide on some of the other stuff. So Anna, who's down in the front, she spoke yesterday. She's one of my colleagues at CamCycle, does an amazing job about thinking about the way that we portray cyclists. So, for instance, like the diversity on our front covers. Cambridge is almost slap in the middle, 50-50 cyclists, male, female, which is very different from anywhere else in the UK. And it transcends, obviously, Cambridge has lots of wealth. It also still has pockets of poverty, and we see extremely high levels of cycling in that. Sometimes you have to just... London Cycling Campaign are really good at kind of doing this, getting out into the community and tapping into these groups that previously have never thought about cycling as well. So it's hard. It's really hard to reach these groups, but you just have to try bit by bit the way that you're thinking about inclusivity, the people that you're talking to. Behavioural change is so complex, but just show that people that they associate with also cycle. And if we can get that, then it starts.
Okay, yes. Well, I was thinking a little about sort of fairly my local neighbourhood where there are already cycle paths. But then cars just park over them. Do I just shove potatoes at their exhaust pipes? Or what's the best campaigning technique?
That's a valid question.
Are you from Manchester by any chance? Because our cycle lanes are full of parked cars. Yeah, it's tricky. That's something that I have a lot of rage about. The only cycle lanes there are often blocked. Sorry, go on, Josh.
I was just thinking about a campaign in Cambridge that is not by us locally. On there's a big issue with pavement parking. I think we can kind of relate pavement parking, people parking in cycle lanes. They launched a kind of very much public letter on the windscreen campaign that kind of got a lot of traction in the press, and then kind of brought up this conversation about how are we going to be enforcing these things? Because ultimately, the lever that we're trying to get to there is enforcement, but how do you, the people who are deciding enforcement, how do you get it up their priority list by identifying that it's a serious issue? So I think getting traction around it, making noise, basically, and then leaning into that those decision makers, that would be my theory of change for this one.
Yeah, and supporting, there are a couple of national organisations who have campaigns on pavement parking. So Living Streets, for example, is one of them. And there are some local authorities and police authorities that have like Operation Park Safe, sometimes they call it, where you can upload pictures of cars that are parked illegally and use that as evidence for enforcement. It's not a perfect system, but you can ask for, in places where there's cars parked illegally near schools, for example, you can ask for more parking enforcement to come and be present more often. Those are things that you can do.
I just add to that as well, because it's a really interesting one, because a lot of the time people do what they think is allowed, and in theory it's not illegal, right, in terms of parking up the curb, or is
pavement parking is not illegal? No,
pavement parking is not illegal. Obviously parking in a mandatory cycle lane is,
and if it's like double yellows on the pavement, there's lots of nuances. Sure. But yeah,
you know, I have on many occasions parked half on the pavement because everyone else was doing it. And then I became a dad and started pushing a pushchair around and realizing that I actually couldn't pass the footpath because there was a car in the way. And for me, that was the moment that made me think, oh, I shouldn't be doing this, should I? And probably if I was a more conscientious person, I would have had that thought before having to push a pushchair myself. But I just operate on, you know, myself, and I'm selfish, but I don't do that anymore. And somehow it's getting that message across that actually, you know, footpaths, cycle paths, they're there for a reason. They're there for a group of people that need them. And, you know, yeah, just don't want to be selfish. All right. We can have another one.
Cyclists, I feel, do need a bit of cycling proficiency to know how to go on a road safely. But where I live, these scooters that have no control by anybody scoot up and down 30 miles an hour, and they can be quite frightening. Is there any way we could have scooter proficiency? That's all. Yeah. Anybody else have that?
Yeah, we'll save e-scooters for another session. No, I mean, anyone feel about?
Well, just that there's a bit of a problem at the moment that nationally, at the moment, e-scooters are technically only allowed in councils where they're running trials. There is no national legislation to... e-scooters are technically illegal in public places apart from in those local councils where they're used. But because you're able to buy them, people don't realise that and they use them. And so there's a problem at the moment where there does need to be some new legislation from DfT that would allow people, that would allow scooters to be regulated. And then, because the ones, for example, in places where they are running trials and they are regulated, the ones that you can hire on the street, they have speed limiters, so you can't ride them as fast as that. But that's not the case for the private ones because they're not currently being regulated. So there is a gap, and there is a need for some new legislation about like a micro class of mobility that it would be, and that would help to address the problem. But I think most people who buy them don't, because it's possible to buy them, most people who buy them don't realise that it's actually not legal to ride them on the road at the moment.
So I work for a local authority as a transport planner, so you all either love me or hate me. But my question, so we are operating in a world, certainly in my local authority, of reasonable funding for infrastructure, but not a lot of funding for actually having the people to deliver it, and a skills shortage, and basically time is precious. There are campaigners and campaign groups who we groan at because we spend hours and hours responding, or the response to the consultation to a pretty good but not perfect scheme is, you've got that bit wrong. We're like, yes, but please let us do it because this is the best we can do. Versus we have groups who campaign who are really, really useful to us, who we have really good dialogue with. We can sometimes get them to write the right letter at the right time to us to enable us to do things. What can we as a local authority do to help campaign groups be the kind of campaign group that uses the resources efficiently of the local authority officers, particularly bearing in mind that if you write to your cabinet member, if you write to your local councillor, if you write to anybody in the council, I'm responding. It comes to me ultimately. It might say love from, you know, whoever, but I've written the words, my colleagues as well. So yeah, how do we engage to be efficient?
Thank you for your question, first off. I could do a bit on that for sure. I think we have regular meetings with officers, and we have a very good relationship. Noting, however, it's not perfect, and it is sometimes our role to be critical and be curious, kind of get into those kind of nuances of when to lean in or not. But I would just say, just develop those relationships, that's kind of where it's at. It's not going to be perfect. You need that tension with the campaign group for those to be effective. But back to the comic, really, don't moan as a campaigner, you know. So like, hopefully we can get some positive messaging out to those campaigners as well, to kind of make sure that they're getting their messaging right. But I think the best way that you can do it is just by talking to them, you know, and building that relationship.
Hi there. Thanks for a really interesting presentation. Can you share a story? I'm not technical. I don't care about curb heights. I'm interested in engaging my community and making cycling look fun, engaging children, parents. Can you share stories of things you've been involved in that get that message out, make cycling look really positive, and something that people in the community just want to get involved with?
We do lots of this, by the way. just that whole positive messaging through our magazine, through our weekly updates, through our Reach Ride, where we take, how many people did we take last year? 700? Nearly 1,000 people cycling, a super family-friendly ride, people of all ages and abilities. And we take photos of people having a good time on their bike, and we share them throughout the year, and we remind politicians of why we're doing this. So, we absolutely have all of that side of the campaigning to support it. But yeah, those pictures of people having a good time riding their bike, those are the ones you want, aren't they? People cycling to school, smiling, chatting. Get those, put them up in as many places as you can, spread the words.
The London Cycling Campaign made a really great little film called London Loves Cycling, which has a lot of that stuff in. And I would also just like to shout out to Critical Mass, which is originally a German movement, but now there are rides in the UK as well, where particularly families, so parents with kids, meet and ride as a group. So it's not, we don't close the road officially, but because we ride as a big group, we take over the road. The last time we did it in Manchester, we had about 600 people, we think, and it was amazing. And because there's so many kids involved, it's very hard for drivers to be mad about. Occasionally there is still the odd one or two, but yeah, and again, there's brilliant pictures from that, and the sort of joy and freedom of being able to ride with a child safely is, yeah, comes across, and I think that's really important.
Thanks. I think what this gentleman was after is one really nice little story that he can retell as his own when he's trying to persuade other people of the benefits of cycle infrastructure. And so aside from our panel here, I mean, Anna, I know you're not actually on stage, but what you do is tell stories, right? Do you have one really good story that could fit in 30 seconds that this gentleman could retell to his friends?
No pressure there at all. Thanks, Wes. I think some of the stories from Camp Cycle is based in the same building as our local bikeability provider called Outspoken Training, and they train adults as well as children, do lots of one-to-one sessions. And I think it's there where some of the real stories come out, you know, families that haven't been able to get around and then they've had this one-to-one training and now they're like, wow, the whole city has opened up to me now. Or we have a local group, a local charity within the city, Red Hen Project, which works with families who are deprived. And Cambridge is a really unequal city. It's not all middle class. It's really high levels of inequality. And there was one family, mother, she had six children. She's really struggling to get all her children to the places they needed to go. Somebody donated her a cargo bike and that just transformed her life, you know. Being able to have that freedom. And one other story, we are working with a community in North Cambridgeshire in the Fens, where, again, very high levels of transport poverty and inequality, and working with them on a cycle lane from the village of Guyhern to the town of March, where there's a railway station. And just having that cycle lane will just open up university, open up education and employment opportunities, and it just means so much to them. So really, like, tapping into those stories of, yeah, this, like we started, it's not just about transport, it's about health, it's about education and all the opportunities. So really tapping into, yeah, what we have to gain when we make these changes.
Thank you very much, Anna. Well done on the spot. We've got 5 minutes left of our session, so probably time for maybe two more questions, you think? Less than 5 minutes.
Hello, just a quick one for me then. I'm from Derbyshire and we've just elected a new Midlands Mayor, East Midlands Mayor, and I'd like to ask, what's the best thing we can say to them? What's the best campaign that we could do? Because you've got a mayor, haven't you, and you've got a transport authority. What's the best active transport thing that we could actually campaign to start off with them?
The best. I don't know exactly what transport powers the mayor will have. Okay. But I mean, one of the ways we talk about the importance of the active travel network in Greater Manchester is that it is like the glue that holds the rest of the network together. And so now that the mayor is, we've brought buses back under public control in Greater Manchester, so that we are now responsible for that. And that system is only going to work if fewer people are using their cars and therefore more people are using public transport and active travel. And every, like I said earlier, every bus or train journey often starts or ends with some active travel. So those things have to work really well together for the system to work. And so for the authority, that's quite a good argument. And also just that the return on investment for active travel is huge compared to return on investment for roads, for example. So depending on, yeah, what are the sort of funding responsibilities they have, the economic case is also strong.
Great. One more question.
As you're right at the front.
My feeling, and I think about this all the time, just like you guys, but I just don't do much about it, except that I cycle, is that we need, if we want to get more people cycling, and we need to make it safer for everybody. Yeah. And you've covered a lot of that, but we also need to make it easier. And we haven't talked about integrated transport so much today. My feeling is that we need to make it easy so people can just roll onto trains and take their bikes onto buses, do that extra bit. And so if you agree with me, if you do agree with me, if you don't, you can say, what can we do? Because it's such a big thing across so many different organizations. What can we do to campaign for that? Because I'll do it if you tell me.
Well, one plug I'd like to give is for Cycling UK, because they are looking at kind of national campaigns. And perhaps that is an example of something where influencing government who are, you know, at the moment thinking about the rail system, for instance, could be. And so I'm a big fan of supporting Cycling UK, who lead on those national campaigns.
I would also find out if you have got a local walking or cycling or active travel group. So there's a great group in Manchester called Walk Ride Great in Manchester. They were campaigning for a long time to get bikes on trams for the very reason you talk about. It wasn't currently possible. Eventually, TFGM have run a trial. They're thinking about that at the moment, which would be a game changer for the integration of the network. So, like, find out if there's any energy already in a particular piece of that, which doesn't answer the whole puzzle all at once, but I think makes the case that that integration is needed.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Thank you, all of you, for coming and joining us today. Thank you to my fine panellists for being up here and sharing your wisdom. So thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.